Kirk was involved in Philadelphia Biblical University, and he left shortly I got here. I guess I won't take any offense with that. And for the last, I guess, almost 10 years, he's been ministering down in Texas. And he came up here, and we're glad for the opportunity for Eric to come, introduce himself and the family, let us know a little bit what's going down there in the heart of Texas, and then preach God's Word to us.
I always thought it was strange that we take an offering before the sermon. I always felt like you should see how much money you're getting worth out of the sermon before you give. So out of a lot of faith, I brought some extra buckets because I knew your plates weren't big enough. Those will be used in just a minute for something else. It's a great privilege to be here. As Pastor Scogan introduced us, we used to attend here and sort of could say that we cut our teeth here. Really learned some of the ins and outs of real ministry here at this church. Got to be friends with many of you. And it's a real privilege to stand here and to be able to speak to you this morning. I am the teaching pastor at our church back in Texas, in Manchac, Texas, which is a small town just south of Austin, Texas. And I'm the teaching pastor there, so I get to stand up and do all the teaching. And we have another guy that does all the administrating, so I get the best of both worlds. I get the best of my world, and he gets the worst of the other world. I don't know how that works exactly. But I do want to invite you back personally tonight. Colleen's going to be singing. And so, you know, when I met Colleen, she was standing up front of our church back in Texas singing. And I said, man, I could marry a girl with a voice like that. And so I went up to her after church and I asked her to marry me. And the rest has been downhill ever since. I mean, it's been uphill. It's been an uphill battle. I mean, it's been really good. It's been really good. We're going to be looking at the book of James, and I'm very glad to hear that you've been memorizing some of James. I won't quiz you on that this morning, but we're going to be looking at James. You know, James is a book of action. James has 108 verses in it, and maybe you'll memorize all 108 of those verses. I don't know. But in those 108 verses, there are 54 commands. Now, if you do a little bit of math, you find out that there are one command for every two verses, an exhortation, a direct statement that says, you've got to do this. So much so, as a matter of fact, that some people along the ways have actually discounted James as an authentic book of the Bible. Martin Luther, the great Reformation preacher, said James is not a book of the Bible because it counteracts Paul's doctrine on the issues of faith. Well, you know, everyone is off a little bit every now and then, and Martin Luther was off there a little bit too. He's a good guy, though, otherwise. But we're going to look at James. Now, James, I don't know if you knew this or not, but James has five buckets in the first chapter. Well, it doesn't really have buckets, but I like to use buckets to demonstrate what James is talking about. That's what the buckets are for. And so whenever you see a picture of a bucket up on the screen, you'll know that it's time for another bucket lesson. All right? James is truly a book of faith. And my computer's... there we go. James is strongly bent on encouraging his readers to action or to works. But James is not a book contrary to faith. It is a book that is built strongly on the notions of faith instead. Faith without works cannot be called faith, you see in the book of James. Faith without works is dead. And a dead faith is worse than no faith at all. Faith must work. It must produce. It must be visible. Verbal faith is not enough. Mental faith is insufficient. Faith must be there. It must be more. It must inspire action. James integrates faith with true experience. Faith must manifest itself in works of action. Faith endures trials. Trials come and go. But a strong faith will face them head on and develop endurance. Faith understands temptations. It will not allow us to consent to our lust and slide into sin. Faith obeys the Word. It will not merely hear and not do. Faith produces doers. Faith harbors no prejudice. For James, faith and favoritism cannot coexist. Faith displays itself in works. Faith is more than mere words. It is more than knowledge. It is demonstrated by obedience. It is overtly responding to the promises of God. Faith controls the tongue. Faith acts wisely. It gives us the ability to choose wisdom that's heavenly and to shun wisdom that's earthly. Faith produces separation from the world and submission to God. It provides us with the ability to resist the devil and humbly draw near to God. And finally, faith waits patiently for the coming of the Lord. Through trouble and trial, those things, faith will stifle complaining. And all of that can be found in the book of James. But we'll concentrate on the first chapter only, in a rather summary fashion. Now, Pastor told me I had till 1 o'clock. Is that right? Yeah, thank you. Very good. And so we won't get into any arguments about that. James, I love James because he gets right into it. And he says, he starts with a recognition, first of all, of who he is. He calls himself a bondservant. Now, we like to say bondservant because that's a nice, mellow word. But you know, the word there is really the same word for slave. You can translate a bondservant. Sometimes it's translated servant. Sometimes it's translated as slave. What's the difference, really? One is it's really the perspective of the person that's involved. See, we tend to think of a slave from the perspective of the master, the guy that's up there beating and prodding and forcing him away. And if he's a slave owner, then he's doing something harsh. And if he's a master of a servant, then he's a little kinder. But from the perspective of the servant or slave or bondservant, it's all about submission and recognizing who the master is and your submission to him. We are that total, we are to be totally submissive to the Lord God Himself. And He writes to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. I like that word scattered because it's the Greek word for diaspora. Now, I'll give you a few Greek words along the way. I don't usually just sprinkle them out there because you're going to forget them anyhow. Not that you have bad memories or anything, but I don't expect you to remember much of Greek words. I paid a lot for that education, so I have to remember them. But diaspora, you know that word because it's the word for use for the dispersion, the diaspora of the Jewish people. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But it's the same word that's used by a farmer when he scatters seeds. Now, if you're going to be a seed, how useful are you going to be until you're scattered? If you're going to be out there in the bucket where the seed is held, this is not my first bucket illustration, but I could add this one, actually. Now, if you're going to put your seeds in the bucket and keep them in the barn, how useful are they going to be? Not very useful. But you have to get the seeds out of the bucket, put them into the ground, get them dirty and wet and yucky and dispersed in order for them to be useful. Now, the scattering of the Jewish people was not necessarily their choice, their choosing. It was part of a persecution, part of really their disobedience. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. It jumps right in. My brethren, this is the first verb of the post-introduction, you know, first verse introduction, hi, how are you? Second verse, he gets right into the action. He says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Now, count. If I told you to sit there and count to 100, you might think be able to do that mindlessly. But if I put a bunch of items out before you and you had to start counting them, and while you're counting them, I'm going 1, 7, 8, 12, 14, 6, 7, 3, 5. If I'm doing that, what's that going to do to you? You're going to lose your count, right? Why is that? Because in order to count, you have to be able to concentrate a little bit. Counting is a conscious action. It's not something that happens normally. Trials come along and I go, whew, that's a good one. I like that one. That just jumps right into joy. No, it's something you have to do consciously. You have to make a decision to do that. But it is not just counting some joy, it is counting all joy. I love this. Because this is a Greek word that you don't normally get to hear. This Greek word should rather be translated as opposed to all. It should be translated as, you ready for this? All. It's not just some, it's not just a little bit, it's all. Now, how do we think of all? You think so? There's two ways to look at this. Trial comes along, and I say, I'm going to count that all joy. In other words, the whole trial is joy. That's one way to look at it, but really, the more of what he's saying is, every trial that comes along, I'm going to count as joy. Here's how it works. Look, I got two buckets in life. For those of you in the back there, this says joy, all right? And this one says not. So I got two buckets. There's the joy bucket, and there's the not joy bucket. So when life comes along and something bad happens to you, a trial, a tribulation, a difficulty, he says count it all joy. So if I'm going to count it all joy, which bucket does it have to go into? It's got to go into the joy bucket. Now, that doesn't mean I feel happy about it, love it. I'm looking forward to the next one. You know, this morning when I got up, I didn't say, Lord, please bring me some trials. Didn't say that. You probably said that about me, you know. But I didn't say that about myself, because those are going to come anyhow. But when the trials do come, he says, I want you to stick it in there. Here's something interesting. A lot of times we'll come to a trial and we'll say, well, that one I can't really be thankful for. I can't really count that as my joy bucket, because I caused that trial myself. I sinned. I produced an error that put me into trial, and therefore that's not a trial. I deserve that trial. And because I deserve that trial, I should wallow in that trial, and I shouldn't count it as joy. He says, no. This is all joy, whether you caused it or someone else caused it. Well, that's the other problem. Someone says, well, I didn't do anything to get this trial. Someone else did this to me. My wife did that to me. She's really good at that. And I say, no, my wife did this. That's not joy. And he says, no, if your wife does it, it's joy. That's all right in there in the text. Now, how do I know this is true even just from the context? Not only just the word all, but think about who he's writing to. What did he just say? Writing to the 12 tribes that are scattered abroad. Is it nice to be scattered? Why are these guys scattered? They're Jewish people. The 12 tribes are obviously writing to Jewish Christians, Jewish believers. And when you talk about the scattered people, the diaspora, when did the dispersion first happen? Well, it happened about 780 or so, 720 B.C. with the Assyrians coming in to take the Israelites out. And then it really finished up in 586 B.C. with the Babylonians coming down to Israel, scattered them, took them across, scattered them, and now they're all over the world. Now, when is James being written? Sometime after that. 40, 50, so A.D. Probably one of the first books in the New Testament. So it's been at least about 600 years since the Jewish people were scattered. So the guys he's writing to, was it their fault that they were scattered? Why were they scattered? We should mention that. Deuteronomy 28, 29, and 30. Moses says, hey, you're about to go into the land. If you obey God, you will receive blessings. If you disobey God, you're going to be cursed. And what's going to happen to you? Scattered. And so what happens to them? Disobeyed. They were scattered. Now we come along 600 years later. God goes, my great, 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 great grandfather sinned. Oy vey. Now I'm scattered. And it's not my fault. Joy bucket. Right? So whatever your trials are, they go into the joy bucket. Then he says, just to make sure he seals the deal, no way to get out of this, he says various trials. That's not just the trials that are this kind of this color or this sort or this type. It is various. It's all kinds of trials, whatever they may be. So we have the two buckets that they go into. Now, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. This word for knowing is the experiential knowledge. It's knowledge that I've gone through this trial before or another trial before, and I've seen how God works in my life, and I've experienced that, and I know it. And so next time it comes along, it should be a little easier for me to put that into the joy bucket because I've seen that before. Now, maybe you've experienced a trial before where the Lord has brought you through that situation. And the next time the trial comes up, you forget. So next time what I suggest is when you get through that trial, write it down. And then when you come to the next one, you can pull it out. You go, I might not remember it up here because the old noggin's getting a little older. You know, I'm not 50, but I'm 40. I know a little bit. I know what's coming. And so I might need to write that down. But then there's the testing of your faith. Notice what he doesn't say. Sometimes what's not said is more important than what is said. He says the testing of your faith. It doesn't just say that your faith produces patience. Faith is important. Got to have faith. Got to live by faith. But it's not the faith here. It's the testing of your faith. It's not just the testing. We all go through tests, but it's the testing specifically of your faith that produces this thing in your life. But in order for this to happen, another key word here is the word let. You've got to let this take place in your life. Testing comes. Trial comes. You say, joy bucket. That's part, again, of the conscious effort, the counting, the making the choice to do that, and saying, I'm going to let this thing have its positive effect in my life. It doesn't come automatically. There's a participation. See, pastors like to make up new words. That's a new one for today. Participation. And say that 12 times fast. It's kind of like in Hebrews. He says, my son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. We know this passage. You'd like to use it on our children. And but if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. That's the good side. We say, yes, I'm going to endure the chastening. I'm a son of God. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. I will attest to this. But painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruits of righteousness. Notice anything missing from that statement? By those who have been trained by it. You see, the training comes, but you don't necessarily get trained by it unless you allow that to happen. You have to let it happen. Chastening is mandatory. Training is voluntary. Chastening will happen. Training doesn't always happen. The testing produces something great, but there's a hidden prerequisite to this. Let patience have its perfect effect, that you may be perfect, complete, lacking nothing. Now, that sounds pretty good. I like to be perfect, complete, and lacking nothing. Testing of your faith produces this thing of patience. But notice something that he doesn't say again. It's inferred in the statement here. The testing of your faith produces this thing. What if the test comes, for example, about a week ago or so, my car broke down. Had to tow it. So Colleen comes by, and Colleen was driving, and actually it broke down. I went and got her. We tried to get it going. It wasn't going. Got home. Get some rope. Now, I didn't really have any ropes. I had some stout twine. A little heavier than kite string. And it was stout enough. I really don't know why Colleen couldn't do a better job of not breaking that twine while she was trying to pull the car. That was a serious trial, and I should expect that my wife can drive the car in such a way as to not break rope, and when it does break, I lose my cool, and I lose a few rewards, and that's okay because I was tested, and testing produces patience, right? Well, you gotta pass the test. Sometimes you fail. Sometimes you fail. But you got to pass it. Now, how do you pass it? He says, look, you will be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And the very next statement is, if any of you lacks wisdom. Oh, wait a minute, I thought I was perfect and complete, lacking nothing. How can I lack wisdom if I lack nothing? That's because you didn't get to the test yet. This is kind of the pre-test thing. How are you going to pass the test? Sometimes you say, Lord, this is a test. I don't know how I'm going to pass it. He says, you need wisdom. How do you get wisdom? You got to run around in three circles with one foot up and hand like this and while you're doing it, or some kind of funky dance, right? No, you just got to ask for it. And he says, I will give it to you, and I will give to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him, but let him ask in faith with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. Let not that man suppose that he will receive anything. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So, what I have here is believing or not believing. This is the word, by the way, for doubting. The word for doubting is an interesting word. It's actually to make piles. And so what I do is I come over here and I'm going to think through this process. It's good to make piles, by the way. It's good to say, well, here are the positive reasons why I should do this, and here's the negative reasons, and I'm thinking through this process, and I'm going to trust the Lord. I don't know how it's going to work out, but I'm going to trust Him. I believe, right? Because the Lord is good. It is He who has said it, and I will trust Him at His Word. And then a minute later, I go, but wait a minute. What about that? If I take something out of this pile and I put it over here in the don't believe pile, and then I go, oh, but wait a minute, but the Lord is good. So I take it out of that pile and I put it in this pile. I go, oh, but wait a minute, I'm not sure about this. I take it out of that pile and I put it in this pile. I'm going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. This is the word for doubting. It's to remake piles all the time. And by the way, while you're doing this, you start to get seasick because the waves are coming in and tossing you back and forth, to and fro, and you're not getting anywhere. And when a ship is just flailing around like that, it is not in control of its destiny. Now, doubt here is an adverbial participle. That's another one of those expensive things I paid a lot for in school. An adverbial participle, a participle is one of those ing words. No, it is doubting, or in other words, while doubting. It's not that you never doubt. It's not that you never have fears. It's that faith triumphs. That you move beyond them. That you ask not while doubting. So if you ask while doubting, you get nothing. And what's another way of not getting anything? Not asking. All right, so if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God who gives to all liberally and without reproach, it will be given to him. Okay, so that was the two piles there. So we've gotten joy buckets, the doubting buckets. And then we have the results of doubting is going back and forth, making these piles, unstable in all your ways, not just some, but total instability. And this affects more than just your Christian faith, more than just your Christian face, your church face. It affects everything. You know, we can look one way when we go to church and another way when we go back into work. And this affects your total life. And secondly, it means you receive nothing, nada, zip, zero, zilch. Now, James is interesting because it appears on the first encounter that it's like a book of Proverbs. Like you can jump into verse 9 and read that and get your wisdom for the day, and go to verse 11 and read that and get your wisdom for the day. But really, there is a lot of continuity between each of these different sections in James. It appears he's talking about a new thing here, but he's really not, because he's talking about having faith, trusting, and doing what you need to do. Now, our natural tendency is to put faith in our own abilities. And one of the ways we put faith in our own abilities is to put faith in our wallet. Right? Boy, Lord, I don't know how I'm going to... Boy, I'm going to have to do this in order to get through this. In order to do that, I'm going to have to not do what I should be doing so I can make more money or whatever it is. So, he says, let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation, because as a flower of the field he will pass away. No sooner is the sun risen with a burning heat than it withers its grass, and its flower falls, and its beautiful appearance perishes. So the rich man also will fade away in his pursuits. Wealth, riches, and their fading nature. There's a lot of stuff in here. But the point is this, there's no station in life that's not worthy of trusting God. There's no station in life that's not worthy of trusting God. What is the alternative? Looking to wealth? Looking to riches? It's fleeting. It perishes. Looks good. It's pretty. Like flowers. My wife gets flowers. Like we get flowers. We don't get flowers all that often in the house because I'm kind of cheap and I don't buy them. But around Easter time, we get these lilies. I don't like lilies. They smell. I don't like their smell. And but that's okay, you know, I tolerate them. But after about a week or so, they're in the water and they start to wilt and they smell even worse. Why? Because they're dying. And this is what happens. All things perish. They fade away. Just like riches, just like wealth, it just goes and phooey, it's gone. Now, the next passage, it looks like he's talking about a new thing. But watch out. Blessed is a man who endures temptation. New subject. But what is one of the temptations that we have greatest in life? Put our success ahead of the Lord. To put our faith and our hope and our trust in our own abilities. I really think he's continuing on because he knows something here. He says, blessed is a man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. Crown, not the crown of your wallet. Not the crown of the world, not the crown that looks good, the crown that you wear, but the crown of life. It's a contrast to the previous section, which the Lord has promised to those who love Him. let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and intents and enticed. Rather, then when desire is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Blessed is the man who endures this temptation. Talking about the temptation of stuff, I think, primarily. Certainly, this passage would apply to all areas of temptation. But the key here is looking at this thing. The opposite of this is to be rich in the world and poor in the spirit. Rich in the spirit is receiving the crown of life. Now, this section is a great section on everything you ever wanted to know about how to start sinning, but you were afraid to ask. So I know that many times we forget how to sin, and so you can come to this passage if you really want to know how to do it, and this one will help you out in a great way. Number one, actually, probably a better way to look at this is how to keep yourself from sinning, how to get out of that pit, the cycles of life. A lot of times we get into these cycles, and we get through a difficulty and trial, and I just can't seem to get out of the sin pattern, whatever it may be in your life. And what I have found in my life, my short life, because I'm only 40 and not 50, you start to feel a little bit older when you go to the doctor and he's younger than you. That's just not right, is it? You get moving along in life, and sometimes you feel like you're in this high in mud. And someone once told me, Eric, stand up. And I stood up, and the mud was that deep. It was some kind of magic trick. No, it wasn't a magic trick. The Lord says, just get up and get out of it and stop wallowing in your sin. Number one, recognize the fact that God does not tempt. Number two, temptation comes from yourself. It's opposite the love of God. Notice something here. There's a key here. The crown of life is to those which love Him. Opposite to that is something that's your own desires. You either love the Lord or you love yourself. You love the Lord or you love the world. There's a great contrast here between these two things. Loving Him. If you want to solve the greatest solution to solving your sin issues is simply love. Love the Lord, not loving yourself. And that's another bucket illustration, by the way. Number one, God does not tempt. Number two, temptation comes from yourself. And number three, it starts with a desire that grows into sin. Notice that this. He doesn't say each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. The first temptation wasn't sin. The first temptation for us isn't usually sin. It's when you yield to it. Adam and Eve in the garden. Snake comes along, serpent says, Eve, look at the fruit. Oh, I like the fruit. That's really pretty. And was that a sin? No. Now, see, for you and I, we say, ah, she's already sinned. Nope, that wasn't it. It was when she said, oh, I think I'll have the fruit. Nope, that wasn't a sin yet. It was when she went, oh. Ah, there it was. See, it had given birth to sin. And it becomes full grown into that thing. It's the natural result of not loving others as yourself. There are two things we have to love in the world, or two things we're commanded to love. Love the Lord, love man. If you do that, you got no time for loving yourself and loving your sin and getting involved with all that. And all three categories of sin, the pride of life, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, those are all three opposite the love of God. So here's the bucket. You have sin versus righteousness. Two categories. You know, all of life is either doing the right, did I get that right? Doing the wrong or doing the right. That's it. Now, how do you solve the sin issue? So let's say this is sin, and what's this bucket full of right now? It's always full of something. Air, or we'll call it sin, because it says sin, right? But it's full of air. All right. Now I'm going to get that air out of here. Are you ready? You ready? Got back in there again. Oh, hold on. Ah, it's still in there. How do I get that out of there? Got to put something else in, right? And there's no way you can just get rid of sin. I had a teacher that once said, he says, look, I want you all to think of horses. Horses. He pictured horses. Now here's a horse that's running on the pasture. And the guy, I come to find out later, he raises horses, so that's why he's using horses. But the horse is running on the pasture, jumping over the fences, it's going into the barn, it's eating, and doing all, you got this whole picture of horses in your mind. And then he says, now, stop thinking of horses. Stop thinking about those horses jumping over the fence. Stop thinking about the horses running through the field. Stop thinking. And he keeps saying all that, and he goes, what are you thinking about? Horses. I told you to stop thinking about them. Well, you made me keep thinking about them. Well, that's because you can't stop thinking about something. You got to think about something else. That whole replacement therapy kind of thing, right? Where you got to replace the bad with the good, replace sin with righteousness. You don't just stop dying, by the way. What do you do? You live. We're all going to die. But you live. You don't stop sinning. You love. That's the great solution. It's to focus on others as opposed to ourselves. You know, there's something interesting about this whole thing is that we could summarize it this way. If care is not taken, outside testing becomes internal temptation. I'm going to skip that bucket. Sorry, I'm running out of time. You'll have to get that tonight or something maybe. Okay. There's only one kind of bucket for the Father. Here's something he says. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. This is a wonderful picture. God has one kind of bucket. Doesn't have this kind of bucket. Got one. The only kind of bucket God has, the good bucket. Everything that comes from Him is good. You may not like what He gives you at the moment. We may not enjoy that. It may be punishment, discipline, chastening, chastisement, difficulty, struggles, trials. But it's all good. It's all that He has for us. It's good. Now, what's interesting, though, is He says, there's no variation or shadow of turning. The picture in my mind of this, I think it's a pretty good illustration, is the earth. You know, in Pennsylvania, the sun sets an hour earlier than it does in Texas. And it's not just the time change difference. It's an hour, you get an hour less sunlight here. So that's why, you know, that's why I'm so suntanned and everything. But it's darker here. But the sun is shining all the time. You know that? Even at nighttime, the sun is shining just like it was in the middle of the day. All the time it's shining, with very little variation. Now, with our Father, there's no variation. The sun has very little variation. What's the difference? The earth turns into the shadow. Sun's still bright. Sun's still shining. God is still there. God's still shining. No variation, no shadow of turning. But we step into the shadow. We move out of His will. We move into the darkness. And of His own will, He brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of His creatures. He created us with something in mind so that we could grow, produce, succeed, and produce something in life. I'm going to jump down to the very last section here. He says, therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness. Now, this is where the Old King James really shines. I love this. This is my favorite verse in the Old King James. All superfluity of wickedness. See, my daughter, my 2-year-old daughter, I love to say that she is overflowing with superfluity of wickedness. You can say that, you can be in a crowded restaurant, and you can say, she has a superfluity of wickedness. And people don't know you're saying that she is overflowing with wickedness. And it's okay, because people don't like you to say that about your daughter. But it's true. She's fun, though. But he says, lay aside the superfluity of wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your soul. I want to point out a couple things. Wow. This is fun. I love diagrams. How many of you love diagrams? 3 of you. That's great. Don't get too stuck on this, but I want to point out something that I think is really, really neat. I love diagrams. He says, look, you receive the Word. And underneath the word are these modifiers. The Word is implanted. This is important. The Word's implanted. Receive the implanted Word. Wait a minute. Where's the Word? It's already there. How do you receive something you've already got? See, he's not talking about getting more of it. We need to do that. I strongly encourage that. But he's not saying receive more of it in this specific case. He's saying take the Word you've already got. We've got lots of the Word. And he says take that Word and allow it to transform your life. Because that implanted Word is able to do something. It's able to save your souls. And save your souls in this case, I don't believe he's talking about initial salvation, like, you know, becoming a believer. I believe firmly he's talking about the sanctification, the continuing transformation of the believer, saving our souls in the sense of continuing to live the life for Him. You receive it how? With meekness. But this is the key I wanted you to see. You receive it with meekness, and here is another one of those participles, laying aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness. Now, laying aside is a participle, and it's either going to be translated with while or by. And either one will probably work sufficiently. I tend towards the while. So in other words, while you are laying this aside, you receive with meekness the implanted Word. What's the contrast to that? If you're not laying aside the overflow of wickedness, what happens with the Word that's implanted? You're not receiving it. And so that's the issue. And how do you lay aside the overflow of wickedness? What's that? Thank you. You remembered. Very good. See, now I knew the buckets would work. That's what he said already. Don't let the external test become internal temptation. Don't let the temptation have its way, and don't let sin take control. So we lay aside the overflow of wickedness, the superfluity of naughtiness, and receive the implanted Word. It's a Word already there. The point isn't get more of it. The point is let more of the Word take control of your life. And it harkens back to the replacement therapy again, but with a twist. The Word is already there. You just got to live it. Won't hurt to get more of it too, by the way, but we got to live it. So here it is. In summary, we have joy bucket and not joy bucket. Trials come along. Where are you going to put them? Joy bucket. No doubting. Don't go back and forth on this thing. Come to your decision. The Lord says, I will, and go with it. How do you get rid of the stuff that's in there? Fill it with something else. Now, I'll go ahead and give you this one because I got an extra minute. Not really, but I'm taking it anyhow. There's a foundation that we have to set ourselves on. Now, if you take this bucket, I can stand on this bucket pretty well, hopefully. Didn't test it beforehand, but I trust it. Now, bucket's pretty steady. It's pretty firm. But you know, the bucket's on a firm foundation. I like being up here. I feel like Trey now. need to shave a little bit. But now, if I were to take and put a bunch of sand down here and put my bucket on the sand, stand in the bucket, what's the chance that it's going to hold me? Maybe, maybe not, right? I wouldn't hold some precious something that's going to break in my hand while I'm doing it. So you've got to be on a good foundation. You stand on that thing, stand on the Word of God. That's your foundation, and it will hold you. And then finally, everything the Lord gives you is good. It's all good. It's all good. And we just have to trust Him that that's true. All right? Let's close in a word of prayer. Lord, thank You for Your grace. You are all sufficient. You're all powerful. You're all loving. You promised us that all things are for our good. They're not necessarily all good things, but all things that You give us are good. We trust You. We love You. We want to serve You and to be more like You. I pray that You'd help us to count things, all things joy, not to doubt, to put our trust in You in everything, and to look to live for You in righteousness' sake. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. and amen.